Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
First, in the Middle East, AOR, U.S. and Iranian forces remain engaged in a cycle of direct kinetic strikes and proxy operations following Tehran's rejection of a U.S. ceasefire proposal. Second, in the European theater, the Russian offensive campaign faces operational adaptations due to deep Ukrainian strikes, while diplomatic maneuvering continues in Washington and Kyiv. Third, in the Indo-Pacific AOR, open-source strategic analysis indicates China's calculus for utilizing force against Taiwan is highly contingent on 8 intersecting internal and external deterrence variables.
Okay, so with the mandatory disclaimer out of the way, and thank you for that bottom line up front, let's actually get right into the deep dive for today. Because, I mean, for you listening, imagine trying to solve a puzzle, but every time you make a move, like 3 other people reach in and aggressively twist it the other way.
Right. Yeah. It's incredibly complex.
Yeah. And that is exactly the kind of multi-front environment the U.S. is facing right now across 3 totally different continents. So we are going through a massive stack of intelligence summaries today. We're connecting the dots between the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Indo-Pacific. Let's start right in the Middle East, because it's not just harsh words right now. We're talking about actual physical airstrikes.
Oh, absolutely. The kinetic action is sustained.
Yeah. According to reporting from the New York Post, which was corroborated by U.S. Central Command, the U.S. just wrapped up its 13th consecutive night of precision airstrikes. I mean, 13 nights in a row.
Yeah. It's a very deliberate operational tempo.
Right. And these aren't random. The explicit goal here is degrading Iranian military capabilities. They're hitting command centers, drone storage facilities, coastal surveillance sites. But what's really fascinating is that while all these bombs are dropping, there is this intense diplomatic standoff happening quietly in the background.
Well, it's that classic dual-track approach, right? You apply military force and diplomatic pressure at the exact same time.
Yeah.
Like the New York Post and the Institute for the Study of War, or ISW, they reported that Iraqi Prime Minister Ali al-Zaidi actually took a temporary ceasefire deal directly to Iranian officials in Tehran.
Oh, wait, and he did this right after an Oval Office meeting, right?
Exactly. He was basically acting as a middleman after that bilateral meeting. But Iran rejected the proposal completely.
Wow.
Yeah. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi came out and publicly stated that the U.S. diplomatic outlook is, quote, illogical, greedy, and controlling.
So it's just a total brick wall on the diplomatic front?
Completely. And then on the U.S. side, you've got President Donald Trump telling Israel's Channel 12 and Axios that he's prepared to launch a massive attack against Iran to compel a deal.
Yeah.
He explicitly stated that the U.S. could act unilaterally or with Israel to force this issue.
It's just a massive pressure cooker right now. And that diplomatic stalemate is like perfectly mirroring the chaos we're seeing on the water. If you look at the proxy actions and the maritime blockades across the region, I mean, it is escalating fast.
Oh, definitely. The maritime domain is highly volatile right now.
Yeah. ISW reports that Houthi forces attacked a Saudi-flagged tanker, the Ancilia, on July 22nd. They caused a fire on board. And this is basically them violently enforcing their naval blockade. And if you track commercial shipping, you can see the real-world effect. Traffic through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait has significantly decreased.
And, you know, it's important to remember the Houthis aren't doing this in a vacuum. The logistical support pipeline from Iran is just incredibly robust right now. ISW actually cited some Reuters reporting about a specific event on July 13th.
Okay, what happened on the 13th?
So Iran literally flew Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders, advanced missile equipment, and actual physical gold into the Houthi-controlled Hodeidah airport.
Wait, gold, like literal bars of gold?
Yes. Literal gold. Because when you're operating in a heavily sanctioned environment where traditional banking is just cut off, gold is the ultimate untraceable currency.
Oh, right. That makes total sense.
Yeah. So they're flying in the personnel to train the Houthis on the new missile systems, and they're buying the hard currency to just keep the insurgency running. And this network, I mean, it extends way beyond Yemen. Over in the Persian Gulf, ISW reports that unspecified Iraqi militias likely conducted a drone attack on Kuwait's Abdali border crossing on July 23rd.
And didn't they also report explosions on Kuwait's Bubiyan Island? Which is a huge deal because Bubiyan Island currently hosts U.S. air defense equipment. So they are actively poking at U.S. defensive perimeters.
They are. And they're pushing that maritime threat into the Strait of Hormuz, too.
Right.
So ISW reports that the IRGC is claiming a naval mine disabled an oil tanker in the southern corridor of the strait on July 22nd.
Wait, did ISW confirm a ship was actually hit?
No, ISW cannot independently verify that a commercial vessel was hit. But the UK Maritime Trade Operations did confirm they found a floating mine in that exact area back on July 7th.
Okay, well, here is where things get really interesting and honestly pretty alarming. There is a developing claim. It's unverified right now, but it's out of Reuters, cited by ISW. Four sources familiar with U.S. intelligence are suggesting that Russia might be providing Iran with targeting intelligence specifically for U.S. sites.
Yeah, that is a very significant developing thread.
But let me push back on this for a second. We've talked before about Iran using, like, Russian-enhanced Shahid drones against a CIA outpost in Saudi Arabia. Is this new intelligence sharing claim really that much of an escalation? Like, what is the fundamental difference here?
It is a massive escalation. I mean, if this developing claim is true, it represents a fundamental shift in the threat environment for U.S. assets.
How so?
Well, think about it like this. Giving someone a Russian-enhanced drone that's an upgrade in hardware, it makes the weapon fly farther or carry a bigger payload, but providing direct targeting intelligence, that is an entirely different operational threshold.
Because you're giving them the exact coordinates.
Exactly. Enhanced hardware just increases the chance that a drone hits something. Precise targeting intelligence means the drone hits a critical vulnerability, like a specific radar array, or a troop's sleeping quarter, or a vital logistics node. It essentially takes Russian space-based satellites and advanced signals intelligence and plugs it directly into Iran's proxy network.
Wow. So it drastically reduces the reaction time for U.S. air defense systems.
Right. It makes every single launch originating from Iran or its proxies infinitely more lethal.
So if Russia is potentially helping Iran test U.S. defenses in the Middle East, it makes you wonder what Russia is trying to distract us from in their own backyard. And to see that, we really have to look at what's happening on the ground in Ukraine right now. Let's transition over to the European theater and look at how the diplomatic posturing is lining up with the tactical reality.
Yeah, the contrast there is pretty stark.
Right. According to ISW, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio just publicly rejected claims made by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Lavrov had claimed that an agreement was reached at the August 2025 Alaska summit. But Rubio came out and explicitly stated that, no, the Russian proposals at that summit failed.
Right, a total diplomatic denial.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky just met with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, basically reiterating his intent to hold trilateral U.S.-Ukrainian-Russian negotiations by fall of 2026.
But while all that high-level diplomatic maneuvering is happening, the tactical reality on the ground is being dominated by a sustained Ukrainian deep strike campaign.
Yeah, tell us about that, because they are hitting some major infrastructure.
They really are. Ukraine is systematically sustaining long-range strikes on Russian logistics. ISW reports a whole series of successful attacks. We are talking about fires sparked at an NS oil refinery in Ulyanovsk, a huge Wildberries logistics warehouse near Voronezh, and a Krusel dispatch station in Bashkortostan.
And for you listening, we really need to emphasize the cascading effects of hitting these targets. It's not just a fire at a random warehouse. ISW, citing Reuters and the Kazakhstan Energy Ministry, noted that Russia has verbally ordered restrictions on naval vessel movements at the Novorossiysk port.
Right, between midnight and 5:00 a.m., specifically due to the threat of these Ukrainian strikes.
Exactly. And because they restricted the port movements, they had to suspend loading operations at the Caspian Pipeline Consortium oil terminal.
And that creates a massive logistical bottleneck.
Yeah.
When you stop loading the ships, the oil backs up the entire pipeline. You have to throttle intake volumes all the way back at the extraction source. So one single drone threat at a port disrupts the economy hundreds of miles away.
It's just a wild domino effect. But let's move to the actual frontline updates, because ISW details some tactics here that honestly left me kind of scratching my head.
Yeah, the tactical adaptations are interesting.
So in the Kostantinivka-Drushkivka area, Russian forces are doing everything they can to bypass direct small arms engagements. They are using really stealthy infiltration tactics, bringing equipment forward under foliage cover.
Right, relying heavily on stealth and drones.
Yeah, and in the Pokrovsk direction, they are deploying this domestic satellite communication system called RASVET as a Starlink alternative to support their drone operations. Oh, and in Zaporizhia City, Russian special services are reportedly using local dating sites and social media to recruit locals for arson and sabotage.
Which is just a crazy asymmetric tactic.
It's wild. But wait, here's the part of the intelligence report that I wanted to push back on. We just said that in one sector, the Russians are sneaking through the bushes to avoid getting hit, right?
Right.
But ISW flagged this developing claim from Ukrainian sources stating that Russian forces just attempted a mechanized assault in the Dobropetia area for the first time in over a year, and it was allegedly repelled. But why would they use two completely opposite strategies? Like, why rely heavily on stealthy infiltration and drone swarms in one area and then attempt a highly visible, resource-heavy tank assault right next door?
It does sound contradictory, but it's actually a function of how they adapt to very specific microenvironments on the front. According to the assessments in the Kostantinivka area, Russian forces are likely facing a brick wall of robust Ukrainian electronic warfare and entrenched defenses. So a traditional tank charge there would be a disaster. They have to use a scalpel infiltration and foliage cover.
But in Dobropetia, they tried to use a sledgehammer.
Precisely. A mechanized assault, especially one we haven't seen in over a year, suggests that Russian command believed they had found a soft spot. Launching heavy armor is incredibly high risk, but the reward is a rapid, deep breakthrough. Now, the fact that Ukrainian sources claim it was repelled tells us that either the Russian intelligence regarding that soft spot was flawed, or Ukrainian reserves are just incredibly well positioned to counter those armored maneuvers.
Okay, so we've got adversaries actively testing thresholds in the Middle East and Europe. Let's connect this to the strategic threat environment in the Indo-Pacific, because how the U.S. responds in the prior two theaters directly factors into China's risk calculus regarding Taiwan.
Oh, absolutely. Everything is connected in their strategic planning.
Right. So we're looking at a really comprehensive framework here from the Asia Society Policy Institute, authored by Lyle Morris. And they assess that China's decision on whether to actually use force against Taiwan isn't just a simple yes or no. It's a fluid formula of three internal variables and five external variables.
So let's break those down. Starting with the internal variables, the factors largely within Beijing's control. The very first one is PLA readiness, the People's Liberation Army. The Asia Society notes that Xi Jinping's military modernization goal for the year 2027 is critical. But readiness isn't just about having the equipment.
Right, an amphibious invasion across the strait is, like, arguably the most complex joint operation imaginable.
Exactly. And the report highlights a major vulnerability. Recent purges within the PLA have significantly depleted their ranks of commanders who have actual operational experience. And that casts serious doubt on their ability to execute a complex amphibious joint operation.
Okay, the second internal variable is domestic stability. The premise is that the regime needs a stable mandate to weather the massive international sanctions that would follow an invasion. But I want to push back here with a theory actually mentioned in the Asia Society text, the diversionary war theory.
Right, that's a crucial counterpoint.
Yeah, because we usually assume a bad economy deters war. But wouldn't domestic economic downturns or instability in China actually incentivize a Taiwan campaign, like using a massive war to rally nationalism and distract from internal issues?
It's a very real debate among analysts.
Right.
The Asia Society text points out that severe domestic instability creates a highly volatile decision-making environment. Under neoclassical realism, you need a strong economy to withstand a war. But the diversionary war theory suggests that if the regime faces severe economic headwinds, they might calculate that the political risk of doing nothing is actually higher than the military risk of an invasion.
Wow. Which ties right into the third internal variable, leadership legacy. The Asia Society cites statements from Xi Jinping where he explicitly says that political differences cannot be passed down from generation to generation. He is directly tying Taiwan's annexation to his personal legacy.
So those are the internal factors. The external variables are the things outside of Beijing's direct control. The first is Taiwan's trajectory. Under President Lai Ching-te, Beijing perceives Taiwan to be on a path of permanent separation.
Yeah, noting Lai's rhetoric that Taiwan is, quote, of course a country, and the growth of a distinct Taiwanese identity.
Exactly. The second external variable is external events. This encompasses major geopolitical shifts. Beijing is intensely studying the lessons learned from the Ukraine war. They're also watching for shifts in U.S. policy, for instance, if Trump were to formally recognize Taiwan, or conversely, use it as a bargaining chip in a trade deal.
Which leads directly into the third external variable, U.S. military intervention. The credibility of TACOM's posture in the Pacific is the single biggest deterrent. The report contrasts Biden's explicit pledges to defend Taiwan militarily with Trump's reliance on strategic ambiguity.
Right. And the fourth external variable is U.S. allies and partners. The Asia Society highlights that Japan has officially classified a potential blockade of Taiwan as a survival-threatening situation. Plus, you have Australia's AUKUS ties, which factor heavily into PLA operational planning.
And the fifth and final external variable is Taiwanese deterrent capabilities. The analysis details Taiwan's shift toward an asymmetric strategy called multi-domain denial.
Yeah, this is essentially the porcupine strategy. Taiwan knows its goal isn't to defeat the PLA outright. The objective is just to prolong a war of attrition long enough for external intervention to arrive.
Just make yourself too prickly to swallow.
Precisely.
So to summarize all this operationally, we are looking at a threat environment where adversaries across all three AORs, Iran, Russia, and China, are actively testing U.S. thresholds for response, whether it's through proxy blockades in the Red Sea, diplomatic denial in Eastern Europe, or calculating the exact matrix of conditions for an invasion in the Pacific.
That's exactly it. They're actively measuring the U.S. response in real time.
And that is the final provocative thought I want to leave you with today. Consider how that internal variable of PLA readiness in China might be directly influenced by the tactical lessons Russia and Iran are learning on the battlefields of Ukraine and the Middle East right now.
Oh, absolutely.
If adversarial forces are actively sharing targeting intelligence and drone technologies today, you really have to question how quickly those combat-tested innovations are being integrated into the PLA's 2027 invasion timeline, and potentially shrinking the window of deterrence for the U.S. and its allies.
It's a critical strategic question.
It really is. A lot to think about today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you on the next one.